Thank you, Walter. Unlike parking, my talk will be free. So it's a real pleasure to be here and to be back at Santa Barbara. And I want to first thank the organizers for giving me this opportunity. I'm going to be talking about an experiment that was done at Rice University. This is a picture of Rice. That's our old physics building. It's now turning 100 years old this year. We have a new physics building that will be occupied in January. So that's a big, momentous occasion for us. Once every 100 years, we get a new physics building. And also, so experimentally, it was done here at Rice, but theoretically, we had a great collaboration with Eric Mueller and his student, Stefan Bauer. So like others, I'm going to start off with a list of where we've been. And in particular, this field is really come from both Einstein condensation, which, believe it or not, for those of us who have been there all along, 15 years seems like a long time, but it really hasn't been. I don't know where all the time's gone. But I'm also giving this list to be able to advertise a few things that we're doing in my lab that I'm not going to be able to talk about during this talk, in particular solitons and interaction of solitons with barriers. 1D physics with bosons, and also disorder. All right, so there is much interest in this community with Fermi gases. Fermi gases are historically a little newer, but they have this nice feature that they make very strong connections to other areas of physics, in particular condensed matter physics, but also neutron nuclear physics and high energy physics even. So these are some of the few things that connect to condensed matter physics, and you'll hear a lot about it at this conference. Of course, the Fermi-Hubbard model, things that have to do with high TC materials, pseudo-gap physics and so on, anomalous normal state properties, things that we think that we can have an impact on in this field. Mainly because of this nice ability to be able to tune system parameters, including dimensionality. And so what I'm showing down here at the bottom is just a zoo of optical lattices. This is the orthogonal optical lattices, but of course you can generalize these. But you can make optical lattices in 1D, 2D, or 3D to essentially make two-dimensional physics, an array of 1D tubes, as I'll discuss during my talk, and also essentially 0D physics, the mod insulator physics. So in this talk, what I'm going to do is I'm going to relax the usual precepts of BCS physics, which says that you have to have equal Fermi energies to pair BCS physics, and ask what happens when you spin imbalance a system. And in particular, I'm going to ask what happens when you spin imbalance a gas in 1D. And the interest of this, of course, is because of the connection between some very interesting materials in condensed matter physics. Many of the high TC materials have an interesting interplay between magnetization and superconductivity. And so how these two phenomena coexist is a very interesting part of the story of high TC physics, and one that we hope that we can shed a little bit of light on experimentally by looking at these imbalanced systems. So what we're going to do is we're going to obtain a phase diagram of this 1D phase imbalance or 1D spin imbalance system, and you'll see it. There's some highly non-trivial phases that can be revealed in these cold atom systems. All right, so this is the usual BCS story. We have an equal number of spin up and spin down atoms. So this is a system which is not polarized, which is balanced in spin. And we know from BCS that there's a pairing that occurs in a small energy region of order of the gap around these Fermi energies, which are the same, these two Fermi energies for the two different spin states. So now what happens if you magnetize this in some way? If you add a small magnetic field and you imbalance the number of spin up and spin down, or somehow you create a mismatch between these two Fermi energies, and so you have a system like this, This is a system or a scenario that can be created by magnetizing a superconductor, for example, putting a superconductor into a magnetic field. Superconductors generally don't like that. They don't like being put into magnetic fields. We know about the Meissner effect. They generate an internal field which resists the external field, and consequently, you generally speaking, you don't end up with a magnetized superconductor. But there are these interesting materials, iron nictides being just the latest example of those, but also some of these heavy fermion compounds, such as cerium, indium, cobalt 5, where magnetization and superconductivity can coexist. And so this raises these interesting issues of what happens when you imbalance these Fermi energies. It also turns out that it occurs in the cores of neutron stars. So the pairing of quarks and neutron stars is exactly the same situation as illustrated here. And clearly, with cold atoms, we can just simply mismatch the number of spin-up atoms and spin-down atoms. In cold atoms, the two different spin states are really, it's a pseudo-spin state. And so they're really, to mismatch those two Fermi energies, all we have to do is create an imbalance in the population of two hyperfine sublevels. So it's particularly simple to do in a cold atom physics. So just a few years after BCS theory, it didn't take theorists long to ask this question, well, what is going to happen? What are some of the phenomena that could occur in this magnetized superconductor? So this is in momentum space. This is the two Fermi surfaces, the spin up and the spin down atom. This little orange region on the outside of the sphere is where the pairing takes place, in an energy region of order of the gap or so. And what Foldy and Farrell and Larkin and Ovchinnikov said back now about 60, 65 years ago was that you could accommodate a mismatch such as this one in momentum space if the minority spin were to displace itself in momentum relative to the majority Fermi surface. And so that momentum displacement in this case is just equal to the difference in the Fermi momenta for the spin up and the spin down. So what this means then, consequently, is that the pairs, instead of being consisting of plus k and minus k, they actually have plus k plus q and minus k. And so there's going to be a finite center of mass momentum of the pairs. It results in position space and modulation of the order parameter, which you can see here, which you have a pair, then you have an excess fermion, you have a pair, an excess fermion, and so on. And in terms of the gap, in terms of the order parameter, it results in some kind of an oscillation in space, which is equivalent to saying that these pairs have some finite center of mass momentum. All right, so these coexisting and magnetic superconducting order, as I mentioned, can be found in these materials. And the question is there any evidence for these FFLO states? So this is, again, a prediction which is over 60 years old. It's not been verified conclusively. So there is some tantalizing evidence in some of these materials that there is perhaps the FFLO state does exist, but nobody has seen the smoking gun, which is really to see that it tunes with magnetic field in this way. And so if it's really the FFLO state, as you adjust the magnetic field and adjust the magnetization, then you should see this periodicity tune appropriately, and that's not been seen. Okay, so with atoms, it turns out it's very straightforward to make this mismatch. These are two hyperfine sublevels in a lithium-6. They're separated by about 80 megahertz at the relevant magnetic field that we're interested in. And so you apply an RF field, you drive transitions between one state and the other, and you can populate these any way that you would like. So from here on out in the talk, I'm going to define a quantity polarization, which is the spin imbalance normalized to the total number of spins. And for us, we're going to always make the majority component to be the spin up. And so it'll be more spin up atoms than spin down, and consequently this quantity will be positive. And the idea then in the experiment is that you can measure P. by independently measuring the number in the two spin components. All right, so the first experiments were about 4 or 5 years ago at MIT and at Rice, and also more recently at ENS. And we've all seen basically a phase separation, which I'll show a picture of in a moment. A little atomic physics before I get there. I know there are a few condensed matter people in the audience, and this is always a confusing point. These two spin states, the spin a half system is really a pseudo spin a half system. And so they really, we're not talking about a system where there can be the spin, there's any spin flip probability. So when we make an imbalance, we make a population of spin up and spin down atoms, it stays that way. And they don't become depolarized. There's no depolarizing collisions speed up. And so this is a little bit confusing because these are atoms that are, their electron spin is actually oriented in the same direction, but it's the projection of the nuclear spin which differentiates them. So they're really two different states, and it really is still S-wave pairing. All right, so this is the phase separation that we see in 3D. This is an image of the majority state, the spin up. This is an image of the minority state, the spin down, and this is the difference. And what you can deduce from these images is that there's a phase separation. There's a very steep phase boundary, sharp phase boundary here. That phase boundary separates a completely polarized ideal Fermi gas, which is this difference distribution, from a superfluid core, from a completely paired, uniformly paired superfluid core. So this is all unpolarized, this is all completely polarized, and this is the phase separation that we see. So it's really important to notice here, to take note of the fact that the paired phase, the P equals zero paired phase, is in the center. And it's surrounded then by a shell of polarized atoms of the excess unpaired fermions. So this is shown here. This is a picture actually that Guthrie Partridge put together. That's not the sun. He says it's supposed to be a laser beam. but it makes a nice dramatic effect because you can see all the nice shading. But this center portion is the kind of semi-transparent portion is the P equals zero phase. This is the core. This is the unpaired atom sitting at the core. And around those paired atoms sitting at the core, around those are the unpaired excess fermions that surround it in another shell. So there's a very clear phase separation. Now, and there's no evidence of FFLO in this system. Now, if we look theoretically, this is obviously in 3D, a very difficult kinds of calculations to do, but Sheehy and Radziowski published this phase diagram a couple of years ago, in which they showed that the phase diagram in the BEC-BCS crossover is dominated by the phase-separated region. This is this dark region. But there's also a little sliver that they predicted of stable FFLO. And so all hope is not lost, but effectively, if you're an experimentalist and you're looking at that, you pretty much say there are other things that you could spend your time on, because this is going to be a really hard, very small parameter region to try to find, to try to locate. And because the chemical potential varies in the trap, it's only going to be a small region in the trap that would have this FFLO at most. And so it looks like it's not, in 3D at least, it remains elusive. But the good news is, and this was come out from some theory in 2007 from Orso and others, who predicted that FFLO, actually going back to Kun-Yang back in 2001, that predicted that FFLO is pervasive in 1D. And so now you don't have any spontaneous symmetry breaking. It doesn't have to generate a spontaneous axis of symmetry in which the order develops, but that is taken care of by the single axis that you have. So it's somewhat of a Fermi surface nesting argument that you can see that the FFLO phase can be enhanced in one dimension. And so all of this in the region, in the center region here, this partially polarized phase, is all predicted to be FFLO at t equals zero. There are two other phases, a fully polarized phase shown here in blue, and then a fully paired phase shown over here in green. Now, in a trap, you're actually, just like in 3D, if you're in a harmonic potential in these tubes, if you have a one-dimensional tube, you can also sample different regions of this phase diagram with one shot, with one image of the atoms. And that's because this is the axis here is the chemical potential, the total chemical potential over here versus the chemical potential difference, or the effective magnetic field. And in a trap, the highest chemical potential will be at the center, and you'll go to zero chemical potential as you go to the edges. But H is constant. If you're in chemical equilibrium, then H is always going to be fixed. You're always going to be tracing out a vertical line here in the trap. So depending on the polarization of the gas, the overall polarization, you could be either to the right of this critical point, PC, or to the left of it. If you're to the right, you'll see two phases, this partially polarized phase in the center, and that's different than 3D, and a fully polarized phase at the trap edge, or if you're sitting down here at small polarizations, then you'll see this partially polarized phase in the center, which is surrounded by edges in the wings that are fully paired. So that's very different than in 3D, because remember in 3D, this fully paired phase sits in the middle. And so in this case, in 1D, it's the middle is occupied by this partially polarized phase. So in the trap, at any given image, we're going to see at most two phases. So for here, we'll see these two phases, or over here, we'll see these two phases. For right in the middle, we'd only see this phase, right here at PC. All right, so this is the experiment. So we set out to do this, to look in 1D, to see what we could see, to see if we could verify that phase diagram. And this is the way the experiment looks. There's a cross beam kind of geometry with an elliptical focus. And these cross beam traps, then these cross beams are then retroreflected upon each other. The lattice beams are shown here in green and in this kind of brown color. And then this is an auxiliary trapping beam for optically trapping the atoms. So the result of that 2D optical lattice, as I showed in one of the earlier diagrams, is that you have an optical lattice in this direction and this direction. It makes a two-dimensional array of 1D tubes. Okay, so it looks something like this, or like this. And these array of 1D tubes can then be filled up with atoms. It turns out for us, we have something like 200 to 240 atoms in the central tube. And the lattice depth can be varied by tuning by adjusting the strength of the lattice beams. And they have some kind of a volume, which is like a half a micron, which is lambda over 2 squared, by something like a half a millimeter in length. And so for us, this is definitely in the 1D regime, because the transverse frequency to the axial frequency, that ratio is about 1,000, which is much bigger than the number of atoms in the tube. So that's a requirement, that's fulfilling the requirement that the chemical potential be small in comparison to the transverse frequency. All right, so this is also the hopping coefficient as a function of lattice depth, and we're operating around in here. This is in terms of recoils, and we're operating in around here at about 12 recoils in depth. So there's some really interesting physics as well as when you turn on this inner tube coupling. Vincent Liu, one of the organizers here, has written a very nice paper on that, and also Eric Mueller and David Hughes and their groups, and other as well as many other people since then. So these are some of the experimental parameters that we're using. This is the Feshbach resonance in lithium 6 in 3D, shown in black. We're operating at above the Feshbach resonance field of 834 Gauss. We're operating at about 890 Gauss. So on the BCS side of the 3D Feshbach residents, and well on the BCS side of the 1D confinement-induced residents, which is given by this red line. So this red line is the A1D. The interactions go like minus 1 over A1D. They give rise to a binding of molecules. Unlike in 3D, you get binding for any interaction. So we're getting binding all along in here. In the one of the important parameters is that the transverse length scale is about 2,000 bore, 1,800 or so, and the 3D scattering length much, much bigger than that. It's about minus 10,000 bore. All right, so this is a calculation by Giuliano Orso showing the value of this PC that I pointed to earlier, whether you're above PC or below PC determines which two of those phases that you see. This is PC versus a parameters which determine the strength of the 1D interaction, essentially. This is for very strong coupling, which would be small values of N and small values of A1D. This is very weak coupling. We're sitting in here and somewhere in the middle, where the predicted PC is somewhere around 17 or 18%. At very strong coupling, it can be as much as 20%. All right, so we set up that lattice, and then to determine where, we do a variation of phase contrast imaging. We call it phase contrast polarization imaging. This goes back really to our early days in BEC. We were interested in getting the best possible estimate of atom number in an optically thick gas. It uses the fact that the atoms are birefringent, so if you send circularly polarized light incident on this bundle of tubes, it will scatter light. They're birefringent, so it'll scatter light that is elliptically polarized, and you can analyze that, and you get something then which is proportional to the optical phase shift or the optical density of the gas. So we do that for both of the for two different shots in order to get images, get distributions for both the spin down atoms and the spin up atoms. This is one shot. This is what the second shot looks like. You then deconvolve those to give you density distributions for spin up, which are shown here in black, and for spin down, which is shown here in blue. And then we also then take the difference between these two to get the spin density. And the spin density is will illustrate, as I show in a moment, where the phase boundaries are in the gas. Okay, and so the phase boundaries will be determined where these different distributions will go to zero. All right, so these, again, this is the phase diagram, which is, in this case, calculated by Eric and Stefan using Beta-Ansatz theory. And the idea here is that when you cross the phase boundary, you know that. So by the fact that the difference distribution, in this case, has gone to zero. So what it means to be fully paired over here in the wings of this density is that the spin density difference has got to go to zero at this point. And so that means that both the spin up and the spin down atoms have the same density from at this location of this vertical dashed line and for all radii above that. And so at this point then defines the phase boundary that is being crossed, which is being illustrated by this vertical line. And the same is true on the other side if you go to P greater than PC, but in this case, this phase boundary is determined by where the minority density goes to zero. And so this is where, beyond this crossing of this line, there are no more spin down atoms, no more minority. And so this blue distribution then has to go to zero. And so what we've done is recast the phase diagram, not in terms of mu and h anymore, but now in terms of the locations and position space of where these density distributions go to zero. All right, so this is the new phase diagram. It's a completely equivalent to the previous phase diagram. It was calculated by Orso and others, but now it's expressed in terms of experimentally measurable quantities. For example, a central tube polarization we get from the Abel transform of the density distribution. And the radii, I just told you before in the last slide, are determined by where these distributions go to zero. Okay, so either this red line is where the spin density difference goes to zero, this blue line is where the minority spin goes to zero, and where they cross is this critical value PC. So again, there are three phases. There's a partially polarized phase, the fully polarized phase, and then the fully paired phase. So the real smoking gun then of this 1D phase diagram is that you should be able to see density distributions that look like this, where you now have the fully paired phase in the wings instead of in the middle, as it would have been for 3D. And that's exactly what we see. So these are now examples of two examples of small polarization, P less than PC, about 1.5% and about 5.5%. And you can see, I think, pretty clearly that beyond radius shown here by this vertical dashed line, the minority and majority spin densities are exactly the same. And over in here, likewise, but now it's occurring at a slightly larger radius. And so at the point where the spin difference goes to zero, that defines the phase boundary there. Likewise, if you go up to something which is close to PC, then you see this phase boundary was moved further and further out, will start moving back in again as you go above PC, but now the phase boundary is defined by this blue curve, the minority, instead of the zero of the red curve, which is the difference. Okay, and so we've seen these, this is really a smoking gun here, where you have the fully paired phase on the edges, and over in here at higher polarization, you get a fully polarized phase on the edge, where the minority, the blue, goes to zero, and you only see the majority, the black one. All right, so this is a comparison now with finite temperature. It turns out that the temperature in the lattice fits best to a temperature of about 175 nanokelvin, which in terms of the Fermi temperature is about 15%. And so all of the data you can see is kind of a little bit of a scatter, but more or less 175 nanokelvin plus or minus about 100. Pretty well incorporates most of the data. And you can see now the beta ansatz theory, which are the solid lines calculated by Eric and Stefan, fit really remarkably well. So this is the phase diagram that results from this. The blue solid line and the red solid line are from the beta ansatz theory, with the only adjustable parameter being the temperature. And the data is shown here for the spin density difference in red, and for the minority going to zero, shown here in blue. And this is, again, the t equals zero phase diagram in comparison to the finite temperature phase diagram. So there's small changes. This only goes out to about 70%. We didn't get any data above that, and so we don't see that one go to zero. But nonetheless, you see a critical polarization here, which is at about 15%. Which is very close to what was predicted from the beta ansatz, which was about 16 or 17%. All right, so I'm finished. We've obtained this phase diagram for this system, which is really a non-trivial, strongly correlated phases. And so I think that this is another example. There's been several now, but another example where ultra-cold atoms are really becoming useful for obtaining phase diagram and information about really highly non-trivial quantum phases. There are three distinct phases in 1D. There's a fully paired phase, a fully polarized, a partially polarized. These density distributions are consistent with finite temperature beta ansatz containing FFLO correlations, But we didn't detect FFLO. We need to do that, and that's what's coming up next. The smoking gun to detect the FFLO would be a direct detection of these momentum peaks, these plus or minus Q momenta. And the way we intend to do that is to allow the atoms to expand in one dimension while maintaining the 1D confinement, to allow them to expand in 1D and for enough time that you can map the momentum distribution that was in the tubes into a density distribution. And if there are FFLO correlations, we'll see two peaks, and they'll tune appropriately with tuning of the polarization of the gas. All right, so let me acknowledge the people who did the work. In particular, Yan-An Liao and Sophie Rittner were the two first authors on this paper. Nature allows you to have two first authors. So they contributed equally to the work. This is Tobias Pabrota, Wenwei Li, and also, very importantly, Eric Mueller and Stefan Bauer were absolutely critical to the success of analyzing the data and mapping out the phase diagram. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Randy, for this beautiful talk and for perfectly staying on time. So we have plenty of time for questions. Okay.
In determining the whole behavior of this system, how important are the interactions between the different spins?
Tubes.
The interactions between the different spins.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'd like to know that,
yeah,
too. But I mean, obviously, there are no interactions between the same spins. But what I'm wondering is, you said there was no there were no free parameters.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me that one at least potential parameter that, mm-hmm, you might want to put in, I mean, maybe it's well known and, mm-hmm, one doesn't need to, and it just comes out. And, mm-hmm, I'm wondering how important it is how do the how does the strength of the interaction between spin up and spin down,
right,
come into determining how
right,
these things behave? Is it irrelevant, or
no? It's
you,
very
do you have to?
It's very important. So the interactions are determined by the Feshbach resonance, of course, just like in 3D. But in 1D, they're determined by this quantity A1D, this 1D scattering length. And in the case of this Feshbach resonance, the A1D changes very quickly when you get close to where the A3D, the 3D scattering length, becomes approximately equal to the transverse oscillator length.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, the G blows up because A1D goes to zero. So as long as you stay away from that, over in here, it's relatively flat.
Uh-huh.
And so you can see it depends very little. In fact, we're on the BCS side of this Feshbach resonance out in here, where you could see where it's relatively independent of A3D. Now, if we change a field by a lot, and we've gone up to 960 Gauss, we've gone down to about 790 Gauss, then it changes dramatically.
And what I wanted to make sure I understood was, mm-hmm, is this affecting the spatial distribution of the atoms as opposed to?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And that's all in there, but not as a but not as free parameters.
Not a free
you just
parameter.
Put in, and you need to have that in order to get the right shapes.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly.
Just a question on the. You seem to oppose the 1D phase diagram to the 3D phase diagram in terms of number of phases.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, so you've shown your nice picture with the, with the sun, mm-hmm, and the laser beam.
Yeah.
Well, you show that you have only two phases in 3D, but this, mm-hmm, disagrees with our results and MIT results.
Mm-hmm.
So, where we have a finite polarization in 3D.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm,
have you anything new to say about that, or do you still maintain that there are only two phases in three dimensions?
No, we've never maintained it. There are only two phases. So the boundary is sharp in our system, but it's not infinitely sharp, and we can't say that there isn't a third phase in that data, in the 3D data. So I'm not saying that there are only two phases in 3D. There are not. I'm sure there are three phases in 3D.
Okay.
Okay, so we have three more questions. One in the back. Maybe you can try to speak without the mic.
Hi, I was wondering about intertube interactions. So if tunneling, you showed the data in the regime where this tunneling was quite weak and 1D physics applies. So my question is, do you have some data when, you know, you lower the confining potential and the hopping becomes much larger, and then you go to this quasi one-dimensional regime?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. So that is in fact what we're working on right now, and we do have some preliminary data, but it's too preliminary really to show it. But we do see that as you start to reduce the lattice depth and introduce intertube coupling, that the system eventually becomes 3D-like. In other words, the paired phase sits in the middle. And we think that that's a very interesting transition going from the 1D to 3D physics, because it involves a massive amount of spin transport. You know, you're going from a phase separation in which in 3D you've got all the pairs sitting in the middle, and in 1D they're sitting out on the edges. And so this is going to be a very interesting system to study, I think, dynamically. But we are seeing that, at least from a more equilibrium perspective, that when you get down to something like 6 or 7 recoil lattices, it looks more 3D than 1D.
Okay.
Randy? So how much of the 3D FFLO physics persists in 1D? So is there any prediction for like a periodically modulated quasi-condensate? Lack of a better word.
I'm sorry, could you
is there, ask? I mean, is there, so I don't have an order parameter in 1D, but do I have some sort of short-range power law correlations, but modulated periodically somehow, as in the 3D case?
In 1D?
Yeah, is there any prediction for that?
I think that would be a correct statement.
Okay.
Yeah. So at least at T equals zero, there should be a, nice long-range correlations, but they may not, they may fall off more rapidly than what you'd expect in 3D.
But there's some, you expect some kind of periodic modulation of that, as
absolutely.
In the 3D case.
Absolutely.
Thanks.
So my question is related to the temperature, right? So you have this three parameter that you feed out of the density profiles, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and there are always these questions about like, thermalization and so on once you get to the 1D regime.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering if you have checked, if you let the system expand,
mm-hmm.
and then you measure the energy, right? And then mm-hmm. BeteAnsat can also tell you, given the energy, what the temperature should be,
mm-hmm.
whether you could get the same temperature.
So are you proposing expanding in 1D or in 3D? Expanding in 1D. So we're working on that. We have not done the 1D expansion experiment, so that remains to be done. The reason why, maybe I should elaborate on that a little bit, but the reason why it has to expand in 1D, of course, is that we're on the BCS side of the Feshbach resonance. And if you release it into free space, then the pairs are no longer bound. And so what we're really looking at, what we want to see is the momentum distribution of the pairs and not of the atoms. And so in order to do that, they have to remain in 1D. And so the expansion really wants to be a 1D expansion, not a 3D expansion, which is technically more challenging because we have to release it in just one dimension and not perturb it too much in the other two.
But you are true 1D, only one.
It's true 1D.
Yes. So
yeah.
Only one transverse.
Correct.
So I guess I have a follow-up question on the question regarding the modulation in 1D. In the time of flight expansion, would you really expect two sharp peaks when you want to probe your pairs with finite momentum?
Whether you call them sharp or not, I guess, is a matter of your own judgment. But there has been calculations, in particular a Monte Carlo calculation by David Sepperly, in which the peaks are visible, but I wouldn't call them overly dramatic. And so, in other words, you get a distribution of momentum, which is dominated by the single particle momenta, and then you get on top of that a couple little horns, which are kind of barely resolved, And so what we're really looking for theoretically is some help in trying to find what set of parameters in terms of, for the temperature that we're at, what set of parameters in terms of the interaction energy and polarization would give the biggest enhancement of those peaks.
Actually, just to follow up on that, would it be advantageous to bind them into molecules and then detect them, the momentum distribution of the molecules, or to get sharper peaks than when you would just look at the distribution of the fermions individual? And then you could do also a 3D expansion.
I think so. So the issue there, of course, is a technical one. You have to sweep the magnetic field. In the case of lithium, you can see how far you'd have to sweep the magnetic field. We'd have to go from there down to, you know, well down into there somewhere. So it's like a couple hundred gauss. And then there's always issues about what's happening. How do you interpret what's going on when you're sweeping it? Are you going fast enough, or are you going too fast? And but yes, there would be, I think, some other than that, there would be good motivation to do it, because then you're looking at these tightly bound molecules whose momentum should be very much clearer than these pairs, and these very weakly bound pairs. So that remains an option. It's just a very technically challenging one, and one, frankly, I feel is a little bit of a compromise in terms of the interpretation of the experiment. You know, if we were able to expand in 1D and be able to see the two momentum peaks in 1D and everything was strictly 1D, then I think that there would be less opportunity for systematic effects to really affect the results.
All right, in view of time, I think we should move on. Let's thank Randy again.
Thank you.
Now the next speaker is Martin Zwierlein from MIT, talking about universal spin transport and strongly interacting fermions.